stare at the wheel. "Looking up," Granau said, "I saw the wheel move slowly. What can be the matter? What is this horrible noise?" Granau ran to Rice, who stood in the engine pit monitoring pressures and the play of shafts and shunts. Granau expected to see Rice hurriedly trying to shut down the engine, but Rice looked unconcerned. Rice explained that he had merely tested the wheel's braking system, which consisted of a band of steel wrapped around the axle. The test alone had caused the wheel to move 1/8 of its circumference. The noise, Rice said, was only the sound of rust being scraped off the band. The engineer in the pit released the brake and engaged the drive gears. The sprockets began to turn, the chain to advance. By now, many of the occupants of the Algerian village and street in Cairo, and performers from the Persian theater, possibly even a few belly dancers, had gathered on the wheel's loading platforms, which were staged like steps, so that eventually 6 cars could be loaded at a time. Everyone was silent. As the wheel began to turn, loose nuts and bolts and a couple of wrenches rained from its hub and spokes. The wheel had consumed 28,416 pounds of bolts in its assembly. Someone was bound to forget something. Unmindful of this steel downpour, the villagers cheered and began dancing on the platforms. Some played instruments. The workmen who had risked their lives building the wheel now risked them again and climbed aboard the moving frame. No carriages were as yet placed in position, Granau said, but this did not deter the men, for they clambered among the spokes and sat upon the crown of the wheel, as easy as I am sitting in this chair. The wheel needed 20 minutes for a single revolution. Only when it had completed its first full turn did Granau feel the test had been successful, at which point, he said, I could have yelled out loud for joy. Mrs. Ferris shook his hand. The crowd cheered. Rice telegraphed Ferris, who had been waiting all day for word of the test, his anxiety rising with each hour. The Pittsburgh office of Western Union received the cable at 9:10 p.m., and a blue-suited messenger raced through the cool spring night to bring it to Ferris. Rice had written, "The last coupling and final adjustment was made, and steam turned on at 6 o'clock this evening. One complete revolution of the big wheel was made, everything working satisfactory. 20 minutes' time was taken for the revolution. I congratulate you upon it. Complete success. Midway is wildly enthusiastic." The next day, Saturday, June 10th, Ferris cabled Rice, "Your telegram stating that first revolution of wheel had been made last night at 6 o'clock, and that same was successful in every way, has caused great joy in this entire camp. I wish to congratulate you in all respects in this matter, and ask that you rush the putting in of cars working day and night. If you can't put the cars in at night, Babbitt the car bearings at night so as to keep ahead." By Babbitt, he no doubt meant the installation of the metal casings in which bearings sit. The wheel had worked, but Ferris, Granau, and Rice all knew that far more important tests lay ahead. Beginning that Saturday, workers would begin hanging cars, thus placing upon the wheel its first serious stresses. Each of the 36 cars weighed 13 tons, for a total of just under 1 million pounds. And that did not include the 200,000 pounds of additional live load that would be added as passengers filled the cars. On Saturday, soon after receiving Ferris's congratulatory telegram, Rice cabled back that, in fact, the first car already had been hung. Beyond Jackson Park, the first turn of Ferris's wheel drew surprisingly little attention. The city, especially its frappe set, had focused its interest on another event unfolding in Jackson Park. The first visit by Spain's official emissary to the fair, the Infanta Eulalia, the youngest sister of Spain's dead King Alfonso XII and daughter of exiled Queen Isabel II. The visit wasn't going very well. The Infanta was 29 and, in the words of a State Department official, rather handsome, graceful, and bright. She had arrived 2 days earlier by train from New York and been transported immediately to the Palmer House, and there lodged in its most lavish suite. Chicago's boosters saw her visit as the first real opportunity to demonstrate the city's new refinement and prove to the world, or at least to New York, that Chicago was as adept at receiving royalty as it was at turning pig bristles into paintbrushes. The first warning that things might not go as planned should perhaps have been evident in a wire service report cabled from New York, alerting the nation to the scandalous news that the young woman smoked cigarettes. In the afternoon of her first day in Chicago, Tuesday, June 6th, the Infanta had slipped out of her hotel incognito, accompanied by her lady-in-waiting and an aide appointed by President Cleveland. She described her first impressions of Chicago in a letter to her mother. "The tremendous contrast between the vastness of the lake, which spreads out as far as the eye can see like a still blue sea, and the unbelievable height of the buildings, some of them with more than 20 floors, creates an immediately unpleasant impression. These great piles of stone kill the poetry and imagination. They bear down on the spirit and on the soul." The buildings would have put her in a bad mood, she wrote, if not for the sheer delight she experienced in moving about the city unrecognized by Chicago's residents. "Nothing could be more entertaining, in fact, than to walk among the moving crowds of people who were engaged in reading about me in the newspapers, looking at a picture which looked more or less like me," she wrote. The next morning, Wednesday, Mayor Carter Harrison picked her up and took her to his house for lunch and a reception. Much was made of the fact that Harrison not only had shed his black slouch hat for a gleaming silk topper, but had kissed the Infanta's hand. That night, she had to attend another official ceremony, this one at the home of Harlow N. Higginbotham, who by now had replaced William Baker as president of the exposition. Here, at her insistence, there was no hand-kissing or bowing. While in America, she announced, she would act in accord with American customs. She shook hands. She visited Jackson Park for the first time on Thursday, June 8th, the day Ferris's wheel turned. Mayor Harrison was her escort. Crowds of strangers applauded her as she passed for no other reason than her royal heritage. Newspapers called her the Queen of the Fair and put her visit on the front page. To her, however, it was all very tiresome. She envied the freedom she saw exhibited by Chicago's women. "I realize with some bitterness," she wrote to her mother, "that if this progress ever reaches Spain, it will be too late for me to enjoy it." By the next morning, Friday, she felt she had completed her official duties and was ready to begin enjoying herself. For example, she rejected an invitation from the Committee on Ceremonies and instead, on a whim, went to lunch at the German Village. Chicago society, however, was just getting warmed up. The Infanta was royalty, and by God, she would get the royal treatment. That night, the Infanta was scheduled to attend a reception hosted by Bertha Palmer at the Palmer Mansion on Lakeshore Drive. In preparation, Mrs. Palmer had ordered a throne built on a raised platform. Struck by the similarity between her hostess's name and the name of the hotel in which she was staying, the Infanta made inquiries. Upon discovering that Bertha Palmer was the wife of the hotel's owner, she inflicted a social laceration that Chicago would never forget or forgive. She declared that under no circumstances would she be received by an innkeeper's wife. Diplomacy prevailed, however, and she agreed to attend. Her mood only worsened. With nightfall, the day's heat had given way to heavy rain. By the time Eulalia made it to Mrs. Palmer's front door, her white satin slippers were soaked and her patience for ceremony had been extinguished. She stayed at the function for all of 1 hour, then bolted. The next day, she skipped an official lunch at the administration building and again dined, unannounced, at the German Village. That night she arrived 1 hour late to a concert at the fair's festival hall that had been arranged solely in her honor. The hall was filled to capacity with members of Chicago's leading families. She stayed only 5 minutes. Resentment began to stain the continuing news coverage of her visit. On Saturday, June 10th, the Tribune sniffed, "Her Highness has a way of discarding programs and following independently the bent of her inclination." The city's papers made repeated reference to her penchant for acting in accord with her own sweet will. In fact, the Infanta was coming to like Chicago. She had loved her time at the fair and seemed especially to like Carter Harrison. She gave him a gold cigarette case inlaid with diamonds. Shortly before her departure, set for Wednesday, June 14th, she wrote to her mother, "I am going to leave Chicago with real regret." Chicago did not regret her leaving. If she had happened to pick up a copy of the Chicago Tribune that Wednesday morning, she would have found an embittered editorial which stated, in part, "Royalty at best is a troublesome customer for Republicans to deal with, and royalty of the Spanish sort is the most troublesome of all. It was their custom to come late and go away early, leaving behind them the general regret that they had not come still later and gone away still earlier, or better still, perhaps, that they had not come at all." Such prose, however, bore the unmistakable whiff of hurt feelings. Chicago had set its table with the finest linen and crystal, not out of any great respect for royalty, but to show the world how fine a table it could set, only to have the guest of honor shun the feast for a lunch of sausage, sauerkraut, and beer. Nanny. Anna Williams, Nanny, arrived from Midlothian, Texas, in mid-June 1893. Texas had been hot and dusty. Chicago was cool and smoky, full of trains and noise. The sisters hugged tearfully and congratulated each other on how fine they looked, and Minnie introduced her husband, Henry Gordon. Harry. He was shorter than Minnie's letters had led Nanny to expect, and not as handsome. But there was something about him that even Minnie's glowing letters had not captured. He exuded warmth and charm. He spoke softly. He touched her in ways that made her glance apologetically at Minnie. Harry listened to the story of her journey from Texas with an attentiveness that made her feel as if she were alone with him in the carriage. Nanny kept looking at his eyes. His warmth and smile and obvious affection for Minnie caused Nanny's suspicions quickly to recede. He did seem to be in love with her. He was cordial and tireless in his efforts to please her, and indeed, to please Nanny as well. He brought gifts of jewelry. He gave Minnie a gold watch and chain specially made by the jeweler in the pharmacy downstairs. Without even thinking about it, Nanny began calling him Brother Harry. First, Minnie and Harry took her on a tour of Chicago. The city's great buildings and lavish homes awed her, but its smoke and darkness and the ever-present scent of rotting garbage repulsed her. Holmes took the sisters to the Union Stockyard, where a tour guide led them into the heart of the slaughter. The guide cautioned that they should watch their feet, lest they slip in blood. They watched as hog after hog was upended and whisked screaming down the cable into the butchering chambers below, where men with blood-caked knives expertly cut their throats. The hogs, some still alive, were dipped next in a vat of boiling water, then scraped clean of bristle. The bristle saved in bins below the scraping tables. Each steaming hog then passed from station to station, where knife men, drenched in blood, made the same few incisions time after time, until, as the hog advanced, slabs of meat began thudding wetly onto the tables. Holmes was unmoved. Minnie and Nanny were horrified, but also strangely thrilled by the efficiency of the carnage. The yards embodied everything Nanny had heard about Chicago and its irresistible, even savage, drive toward wealth and power. The great fair came next. They rode the Alley L along 63rd Street. Just before the train entered the fairgrounds, it passed the arena of Buffalo Bill's Wild West. From the elevated trestle, they saw the earthen floor of the arena and the amphitheater seating that surrounded it. They saw his horses and buffalo and an authentic stagecoach. The train passed over the fair's fence, then descended to the terminal at the rear of the transportation building. Brother Harry paid the 50-cent admission for each of them. At the fair's turnstiles, even Holmes could not escape paying cash. Naturally, they first toured the transportation building. They saw the Pullman Company's Ideal of Industry exhibit, with its detailed model of Pullman's company town, which the company extolled as a worker's paradise. In the building's annex, packed with trains and locomotives, they walked the full length of an exact duplicate of the all-Pullman New York and Chicago Limited, with its plush chairs and carpeting, crystal glassware, and polished wood walls. At the pavilion of the Inman Line, a full-sized slice of an ocean liner towered above them. They exited the building through the great golden door, which arced across the light red face of the building like a gilt rainbow. Now, for the first time, Nanny got a sense of the true, vast scale of the fair. Ahead lay a broad boulevard that skirted on the left the lagoon and wooded island, on the right the tall facades of the mines and electricity buildings. In the distance, she saw a train whooshing over the fair's all-electric elevated railway along the park's perimeter. Closer at hand, silent electric launches glided through the lagoon. At the far end of the boulevard, looming like an escarpment in the Rockies, stood the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building. White gulls slid across its face. The building was irresistibly huge. Holmes and Minnie took her there next. Once inside, she saw that the building was even more vast than its exterior had led her to believe. A blue haze of human breath and dust blurred the intricate bracing of the ceiling 246 feet above. Halfway to the ceiling, seemingly in midair, were five gigantic electric chandeliers, the largest ever built, each 75 feet in diameter and generating 828,000 candle power. Below the chandeliers spread an indoor city of gilded domes and glittering minarets, mosques, palaces, kiosks, and brilliant pavilions, according to the popular Rand McNally and Company handbook to the World's Columbian Exposition. At the center stood a clock tower, the tallest of the interior structures, rising to a height of 120 feet. Its self-winding clock told the time in days, hours, minutes, and seconds from a face 7 feet in diameter. As tall as the tower was, the ceiling was yet another 120 feet above. Minnie stood beaming and proud as Nanny's gaze moved over the interior city and upward to its steel sky. There had to be thousands of exhibits. The prospect of seeing even a fraction of them was daunting. They saw Gobelin tapestries at the French Pavilion, the life mask of Abraham Lincoln at the exhibits of the American Bronze Company. In the United States Pavilion, there were toys, weapons, canes, trunks, every conceivable manufactured product, and a large display of burial hardware, including marble and stone monuments, mausoleums, mantles, caskets, coffins, and miscellaneous other tools and furnishings of the undertaker's trade. Minnie and Nanny rapidly grew tired. They exited with relief onto the terrace over the North Canal and walked into the Court of Honor. Here once again Nanny found herself nearly overwhelmed. It was noon by now, the sun directly overhead. The gold form of the statue of the Republic, Big Mary, stood like a torch aflame. The basin in which the statue's plinth was set glittered with ripples of diamond. At the far end stood 13 tall white columns, the peristyle, with slashes of the blue lake visible between them. The light suffusing the court was so plentiful and intense it hurt their eyes. Many of the people around them donned spectacles with blue lenses. They retreated for lunch. They had innumerable choices. There were lunch counters in most of the main buildings. The manufacturer's building alone had 10 plus two large restaurants, one German, the other French. The cafe in the transportation building on a terrace over the Golden Door was always popular and offered a spectacular view of the Lagoon District. As the day wore on, Holmes brought them chocolate and lemonade and root beer at one of the Heyer's root beer oases that dotted the grounds. They returned to the fair almost daily, 2 weeks being widely considered the minimum needed to cover the fair adequately. One of the most compelling buildings, given the nature of the age, was the electricity building. In its theatorium, they listened to an orchestra playing at that very moment in New York. They watched the moving pictures in Edison's kinetograph. Edison also displayed a strange metal cylinder that could store voices. A man in Europe talks to his wife in America by boxing up a cylinder full of conversation and sending it by express, the Rand McNally guidebook said. A lover talks by the hour into a cylinder, and his sweetheart hears as though the thousand leagues were but a yard. And they saw the first electric chair. They reserved a separate day for the midway. Nothing in Mississippi or Texas had prepared Nanny for what she now experienced. Belly dancers, camels, a balloon full of hydrogen that carried visitors over 1,000 feet into the sky. Persuaders called to her from raised platforms, seeking to entice her into the Moorish palace with its room of mirrors, its optical illusions, and its eclectic wax museum, where visitors saw figures as diverse as Little Red Riding Hood and Marie Antoinette about to be guillotined. There was color everywhere. The street in Cairo, open now, glowed with soft yellows, pinks, and purples. Even the concession tickets provided a splash of color. Brilliant blue for the Turkish theater, pink for the Lapland village, and mauve for the Venetian gondolas. Sadly, the Ferris wheel was not quite ready. They exited the midway and strolled slowly south, back to 63rd Street and the Alley L. They were tired, happy and sated. But Harry promised to bring them back one more time on July 4th for a fireworks display that everyone expected would be the greatest the city had ever witnessed. Brother Harry seemed delighted with Nanny and invited her to stay for the summer. Flattered, she wrote home to request that her big trunk be shipped to the Wrightwood address. Clearly, she had hoped something like this would happen, for she had packed the trunk already. Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pititzel, also went to the fair. He bought a souvenir for his son Howard, a tin man mounted on a spinning top. It quickly became the boy's favorite possession. Vertigo. As Ferris's men became accustomed to handling the big cars, the process of attaching them to the wheel accelerated. By Sunday evening, June 11th, six cars had been hung, an average of two a day since the first turn of the wheel. Now it was time for the first test with passengers, and the weather could not have been better. The sun was gold, the sky a darkling blue in the east. Mrs. Ferris insisted on being aboard for the first ride, despite Grinnell's attempts to dissuade her. Grinnell inspected the wheel to make sure the car would swing without obstruction. The engineer in the pit started the engines and rotated the wheel to bring the test car to one of the platforms. "I did not enter the carriage with the easiest feeling at heart," Grinnell said. "I felt squeamish, yet I could not refuse to take the trip. So I put on a bold face and walked into the car." Luther Rice joined them, as did two draftsmen and the city of Chicago's former bridge engineer, W.C. Hughes. His wife and daughter also stepped aboard. The car swung gently as the passengers took positions within the car. Glass had not yet been installed in its generous windows, nor had the iron grill that would cover the glass. As soon as the last passenger had entered, Rice casually nodded to the engineer, and the wheel began to move. Instinctively, everyone reached for posts and sills to keep themselves steady. As the wheel turned, the car pivoted on the trunnions that both connected it to the frame and kept it level. "Owing to our car not having made a trip," Grinnell said, "the trunnions stuck slightly in their bearings and a crunching noise resulted, which, in the condition of our nerves, was not pleasant to hear." The car traveled a bit higher, then unexpectedly stopped, raising the question of how everyone aboard would get down if the wheel could not be restarted. Rice and Grinnell stepped to the unglazed windows to investigate. They looked down over the sill and discovered the problem. The fast-growing crowd of spectators, emboldened by seeing passengers in the first car, had leapt into the next car, ignoring shouts to stay back. Fearful that someone would be hurt or killed, the engineer had stopped the wheel and allowed the passengers to board. Grinnell estimated that 100 people now occupied the car below. No one sought to kick them out. The wheel again began to move. Ferris had created more than simply an engineering novelty. Like the inventors of the elevator, he had conjured an entirely new physical sensation. Grinnell's first reaction, soon to change, was disappointment. He had expected to feel something like what he felt when riding a fast elevator, but here he found that if he looked straight ahead, he felt almost nothing. Grinnell stationed himself at one end of the car to better observe its behavior and the movement of the wheel. When he looked out the side of the car into the passing web of spokes, the car's rapid ascent became apparent. It seemed as if everything was dropping away from us, and the car was still. Standing at the side of the car and looking into the network of iron rods multiplied the peculiar sensation. He advised the others that if they had weak stomachs, they should not do likewise. When the car reached its highest point, 264 feet above the ground, Mrs. Ferris climbed onto a chair and cheered, raising a roar in the following car and on the ground. Soon, however, the passengers became silent. The novelty of the sensation wore off, and the true power of the experience became apparent. It was a most beautiful sight one obtains in the descent of the car, for then the whole fairgrounds is laid before you, Grinnell said. The view is so grand that all timidity left me, and my watch on the movement of the car was abandoned. The sun had begun its own descent and now cast an orange light over the shorescape. The harbor was dotted with vessels of every description, which appeared mere specks from our exalted position, and the reflected rays of the beautiful sunset cast a gleam upon the surrounding scenery, making a picture lovely to behold. The entire park came into view as an intricate landscape of color, texture, and motion. Lapis lagoons, electric launches trailing veils of diamond, carmine blossoms winking from bulrush and flag. The sight is so inspiring that all conversation stopped, and all were lost in admiration of this grand sight. The equal of it I have never seen, and I doubt very much if I shall again. This reverie was broken as more bolts and nuts bounded down the superstructure onto the car's roof. Spectators still managed to get past the guards and into the following cars, but now Rice shrugged it off. The engineer in the pit kept the wheel running until the failing light made continued operation a danger, but even then thrill-seekers clamored for a chance. Finally, Rice informed those who had shoved their way into the cars that if they remained, he would run them to the top of the wheel and leave them there overnight. This, Grinnell said, had the desired effect. Immediately after leaving the car, Mrs. Ferris telegraphed her husband details of the success. He cabled back, "God bless you, my dear." The next day, Monday, June 12th, Rice cabled Ferris, 6 more cars hung today. People are wild to ride on wheel, an extra force of guards is required to keep them out. On Tuesday, the total of cars hung reached 21, with only 15 more to add. Burnham, obsessing as always over details, sought to decree the style and location of a fence for the wheel. Burnham wanted an open, perforated fence. Ferris wanted it closed. Ferris was fed up with Burnham's pressure and aesthetic interference. He cabled Luther Rice, "Burnham nor anyone else has any right to dictate whether we shall have a closed or open fence, any more than from an artistic standpoint." Ferris prevailed. The eventual fence was a closed one. At last, all the cars were hung and the wheel was ready for its first paying passengers. Rice wanted to begin accepting riders on Sunday, June 18th, 2 days earlier than planned, but now, with the wheel about to experience its greatest test, a full load of paying passengers, including entire families, Ferris's board of directors urged him to hold off one more day. They cabled Ferris, unwise to open wheel to public until opening day because of incompleteness and danger of accidents. Ferris accepted their directive, but with reluctance. Shortly before he left for Chicago, he cabled Rice, "If the board of directors have decided not to run until Wednesday, you may carry out their wishes." It's likely the board had been influenced by an accident that had occurred the previous Wednesday, June 14th, at the Midway's Ice Railway, a descending elliptical track of ice over which two coupled bobsleds full of passengers could reach speeds of 40 miles an hour. The owners had just completed the attraction and begun conducting their first tests with passengers, employees only, when a group of spectators pushed their way into the sleds, 8 in the first, 6 in the second. The interlopers included 3 of Bloom's Algerians, who had come to the railway, one explained, because none of us had ever seen ice. A doubtful story given that the Algerians had just endured one of Chicago's coldest winters. At about 6:45 p.m., the operator released the sleds, and soon they were rocketing along the ice at maximum speed. "It was about sundown when I heard the sleds coming around the curve," said a Colombian guard who witnessed the run. "They seemed to be flying. The first went around the curve. It struck the angle near the west end of the road, but went along all right. The second struck the same point, but it jumped the track. The top of the car, with the people holding tightly to the seats, broke the railing and fell to the ground. As it fell, the sled turned over and the people fell under it." The sled plummeted 15 feet to the ground. One passenger was killed. Another, a woman, suffered fractures of her jaw and both wrists. 4 other men, including 2 of the Algerians, sustained contusions. The accident had been tragic and a black mark for the fair, but everyone understood that the Ferris wheel, with 36 cars carrying over 2,000 passengers, embodied the potential for a catastrophe of almost unimaginable scale. Heathen Wanted. Despite his misgivings, Olmsted left the completion of the exposition landscape in the hands of Ulrich and Codman, and took up a schedule of work and travel that was extreme even by his own punishing standards. He traveled through 16 states and by mid-June was back at Vanderbilt's North Carolina estate. Along the way, in rail cars, stations, and hotels, he solicited the views of strangers about the fair while keeping his own identity a secret. The fair's lackluster attendance troubled him and perplexed him. He asked fellow travelers if they had visited the fair yet, and if so, what they had thought of it. But he was especially interested in the opinions of people who had not yet gone. What had they heard? Did they plan to go? What was holding them back? "Everywhere there is growing interest in the exposition," he told Burnham in a June 20th letter from Biltmore. "Everywhere I have found indications that people are planning to go to it." First-hand accounts of the fair were sparking heightened interest. Clergymen who had seen it were working the fair into sermons and lectures. He was delighted to find that what visitors liked best were not the exhibits, but the buildings, waterways, and scenery, and that the fair had surprised them. People who have gone to the fair have, in the main, found more than the newspapers had led them to expect. He concluded, there is a rising tidal wave of enthusiasm over the land. But he saw that other factors were exerting a countervailing force. While personal accounts of the fair were enthusiastic, Olmsted wrote, nearly always incompletenesses are referred to, favoring the idea that much remains to be done, and that the show will be better later. Farmers planned to wait until after harvest. Many people had put off their visits in the expectation that the nation's worsening economic crisis and pressure from Congress eventually would compel the railroads to reduce their Chicago fares. Weather also was an issue. Convinced that Chicago was too hot in July and August, people were postponing their visits until the fall. One of the most pernicious factors, Olmsted found, was the widespread fear that anyone who ventured to Chicago would be fleeced unmercifully, especially in the fair's many restaurants with their extortionate prices. This complaint is universal and stronger than you in Chicago are aware of, I am sure, he told Burnham. It comes from rich and poor alike. I think that I have myself paid 10 times as much for lunch at the exposition as I did a few days ago for an equally good one in Knoxville, Tennessee. The frugal farming class yet to come to the fair will feel this greatly. Olmsted had another reason to worry about high meal prices. The effect, he wrote, will be to induce people more and more to bring their food with them, and more to scatter papers and offal on the ground. It was critical now, Olmsted argued, to concentrate on making improvements of a kind most likely to increase the gleam in the stories people took back to their hometowns. This is the advertising now most important to be developed, that of high-strung, contagious enthusiasm growing from actual excellence, the question being not whether people shall be satisfied, but how much they shall be carried away with admiration and infect others by their unexpected enjoyment of what they found. Toward this end, he wrote, certain obvious flaws needed immediate attention. The exposition's gravel paths, for example. There is not a square rod of admirable, hardly one of passable, gravel walk in all of the exposition ground, he wrote. It appears probable to me that neither the contractor nor the inspector, whose business it is to keep the contractor up to his duty, can ever have seen a decently good gravel walk, or that they have any idea of what good gravel walks are. What are the defects of your walks? Your walks, he says here, not mine or ours, even though the walks were the responsibility of his own landscape department. In some places there are cobbles or small boulders protruding from the surface, upon which no lady with summer shoes can step without pain. In other places the surface material is such that when damp enough to make it coherent, it becomes slimy, and thus unpleasant to walk upon. Also, without care, the slime is apt to smear shoes and dresses, which materially lessens the comfort of ladies. His voyage to Europe had shown him that a really good gravel path should be as even and clean as a drawing-room floor. The cleanliness of the grounds also fell short of European standards, as he had feared it would. Litter was everywhere, with too few men assigned to clean it up. The fair needed twice as many, he said, and greater scrutiny of their work. I have seen papers that had been apparently swept off the terraces upon the shrubbery between them and the lagoons, Olmsted wrote. Such a shirking trick in a workman employed to keep the terraces clean should be a criminal offense. He was bothered, too, by the noise of the few steam vessels that Burnham, over his repeated objections, had authorized to travel the exposition's waters alongside the electric launches. The boats are cheap, graceless, clumsy affairs, as much out of place in what people are calling the court of honor of the exposition as a cow in a flower garden. Olmsted's greatest concern, however, was that the Jackson Park portion of the exposition simply was not fun. There is too much appearance of an impatient and tired doing of sightseeing duty, a stint to be got through before it is time to go home. The crowd has a melancholy air in this respect, and strenuous measures should be taken to overcome it. Just as Olmsted sought to conjure an aura of mystery in his landscape, so here he urged the engineering of seemingly accidental moments of charm. Concerts and parades were helpful, but of too stated or programmed a nature. What Olmsted wanted were minor incidents of a less evidently prepared character, less formal, more apparently spontaneous and incidental. He envisioned French horn players on the wooded island, their music drifting across the waters. He wanted Chinese lanterns strung from boats and bridges alike. Why not skipping and dancing masqueraders with tambourines, such as one sees in Italy? Even lemonade peddlers would help if moving about in picturesque dresses, or cake sellers appearing as cooks, with flat cap and in spotless white from top to toe. On nights when big events in Jackson Park drew visitors away from the Midway, could not several of the many varieties of heathen, black, white, and yellow, be cheaply hired to mingle unobtrusively but in full native costume with the crowd on the main court? When Burnham read Olmsted's letter, he must have thought Olmsted had lost his mind. Burnham had devoted the last 2 years of his life to creating an impression of monumental beauty, and now Olmsted wanted to make visitors laugh. Burnham wanted them struck dumb with awe. There would be no skipping and dancing, no heathen. The exposition was a dream city, but it was Burnham's dream. Everywhere it reflected the authoritarian spandrels of his character, from its surfeit of policemen to its strict rules against picking flowers. Nowhere was this as clearly evident as in the fair's restrictions on unauthorized photography. Burnham had given a single photographer, Charles Dudley Arnold, a monopoly over the sale of official photographs of the fair, which arrangement also had the effect of giving Burnham control over the kinds of images that got distributed throughout the country, and explains why neat, well-dressed, upper-class people tended to populate each frame. A second contractor received the exclusive right to rent Kodaks to fair visitors, the Kodak being a new kind of portable camera that eliminated the need for lens and shutter adjustments. In honor of the fair, Kodak called the folding version of its popular model number 4 box camera the Columbus. The photographs these new cameras created were fast becoming known as snapshots, a term originally used by English hunters to describe a quick shot with a gun. Anyone wishing to bring his own Kodak to the fair had to buy a permit for $2, an amount beyond the reach of most visitors. The Midway's street in Cairo imposed an additional $1 fee. An amateur photographer bringing a conventional large camera and the necessary tripod had to pay $10, about what many out-of-town visitors paid for a full day at the fair, including lodging, meals, and admission. One morning, an artist named F. Hopkinson Smith appeared at the fair's 57th Street entrance and presented an entry pass to the guard. Smith squeezed his wood paint box, white umbrella, portable stool, and three-legged easel through the turnstile and set off toward the Court of Honor, hoping to record forever the beauty of the fair and confident that he possessed Charles Atwood's personal authorization to do so. He had gone only a few steps when one of the Colombian guards stopped him. "You can't take that in," the guard said. "Can't take what in?" Smith replied. "That tripod." "What tripod?" The young guard pointed at the easel. "That there tripod that you've got covered up there. Kodaks is $2. Cameras is $10. Smith denied the easel was a tripod. The guard gave him a thin smile. A crowd piled up in the gate behind Smith. One faction, he said, was anxious to throw me over the fence for blocking up the turnstile. The other could not afford the admission fee and urged him to stand his ground. That group, Smith believed, hoped for a fight. With exaggerated slowness, Smith took out his umbrella and opened it, then sat up and carefully adjusted his stool. The guard was not satisfied. He searched Smith's palette, paint rags, and color box. Finding no hidden camera, he consulted a superior, who allowed Smith to enter the grounds. Smith quickly made for the Art Palace, where he planned to sketch the building's interior rotunda. He had just reached the center of the rotunda when another guard touched him on the shoulder. "Sorry, sir, but you can't bring that through here." "It's not a camera," Smith said. "I know, sir, but nobody is allowed to copy pictures here. It's let to a Philadelphia concern." Smith walked back outside and moved around the building until he found a place that appealed to him, in the shadow of one of the building's porticos. There he set up his stool and easel and began to work. It was a bright, cool day. A perfect day. Sun fell through the trees and paisleyed the walk. He began sketching. Crisp morning shadow embraced the belly of a giant lion cast in staff. A Venetian gondola eased along the adjacent canal. Olmsted's electric launches glided past. The morning had been salvaged after all. Spectators gathered to watch him work. A ticket taker for the launches, deploying a common expression of the day, told Smith his sketch was way out of sight. Soon a shadow fell across his paper. He looked up to find another Colombian guard blocking his view. "The captain of the guard has sent me to ask by whose order you paint here," he said. Smith stared back, astonished. It was one thing to bar him from sketching inside the building, but outside? Then the absurdity of the inquiry broke over me, Smith recalled. Millions of money spent to develop art in America. A city built, as it were, in a day, the story of whose grandeur and beauty it would take a century to forget. The most exquisite art building of modern, and perhaps of any time, casting its shadow at that very moment over my easel, sheltering and enshrining the marbles and canvases of the greatest masters of modern art. The whole world bidden to come and feast its eyes, and then one of its guests and devotees debarred from paying his tribute on a bit of paper 10 inches square. Smith did not believe it. "Do you really mean, guard, that I cannot paint here without somebody's permission?" The guard was himself astonished at Smith's astonishment. "Yes," he said, and gave Smith a look of pity that suggested that any man who imagined he could paint the grounds with impunity must harbor some underlying mental defect. "You might as well have asked him whether you might break the tail of the lion and carry it away as a souvenir," Smith recalled. He told the guard that Charles Atwood, the fair's supervising architect and designer of the Art Palace, had himself authorized the foray. The guard watched Smith a moment. He opened one button of his tunic and with two fingers drew from within a small notebook and a pencil. He wrote, "Permit of Mr. Atwood." He walked away. Smith returned to his work, hoping to finish before the sun rose high enough to bleach all shadow from the day. For all Burnham's obsession with detail and control, one event at the fair escaped his attention. On June 17th, a small fire occurred in the cold storage building, a castle-like structure at the southwest corner of the grounds built by Hercules Ironworks. Its function was to produce ice, store the perishable goods of exhibitors and restaurants, and operate an ice rink for visitors wishing to experience the novelty of skating in July. The building was a private venture. Burnham had nothing to do with its construction beyond approving its design. Oddly enough, its architect was named Frank P. Burnham, no relation. The fire broke out in the cupola at the top of the central tower, but was controlled quickly and caused only $100 in damage. Even so, the fire prompted insurance underwriters to take a closer look at the building, and what they saw frightened them. A key element of the design had never been installed. 7 insurers canceled their policies. Fire Marshal Edward W. Murphy, acting chief of the World's Fair Fire Department, told a committee of underwriters, "That building gives us more trouble than any structure on the grounds. It is a miserable fire trap and will go up in smoke before long." No one told Burnham about the fire. No one told him of the cancellations. And no one told him of Murphy's forecast. At last. At 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, June 21st, 1893, 51 days late, George Washington Gale Ferris took a seat on the speaker's platform built at the base of his wheel. The 40-piece Iowa State Marching Band already had boarded one of the cars and now played "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." Mayor Harrison joined Ferris on the platform, as did Bertha Palmer, the entire Chicago City Council, and an assortment of fair officials. Burnham was not present. The cars were fully glazed, and wire grills had been placed over all the windows, so that, as one reporter put it, "No crank will have an opportunity to commit suicide from this wheel. No hysterical woman shall jump from a window." Conductors trained to soothe riders who were afraid of heights stood in handsome uniforms at each car's door. The band quieted, the wheel stopped. Speeches followed. Ferris was last to take the podium, and happily assured the audience that the man condemned for having wheels in his head had gotten them out of his head and into the heart of the Midway Plaisance. He attributed the success of the enterprise to his wife, Margaret, who stood behind him on the platform, then dedicated the wheel to the engineers of America. Mrs. Ferris gave him a gold whistle, then she and Ferris and the other dignitaries climbed into the first car. Harrison wore his black slouch hat. When Ferris blew the whistle, the Iowa State Band launched into America, and the wheel again began to turn. The group made several circuits, sipping champagne, smoking cigars, then exited the wheel to the cheers of the crowd that now thronged its base. The first paying passengers stepped aboard. The wheel continued rolling with stops only for loading and unloading until 11 o'clock that night. Even with every car full, the wheel never faltered, its bearings never groaned. The Ferris Company was not shy about promoting its founder's accomplishment. In an illustrated pamphlet called The Ferris Wheel Souvenir, the company wrote, "Built in the face of every obstacle, it is an achievement which reflects so much credit upon the inventor that were Mr. Ferris the subject of a monarchy instead of a citizen of a great republic, his honest heart would throb beneath a breast laden with the decorations of royalty." Ferris could not resist tweaking the exposition company for not granting him a concession sooner than it did. "Its failure to appreciate its importance," the souvenir said, "has cost the exposition company many thousands of dollars." This was an understatement. Had the exposition company stood by its original June 1892 concession, rather than waiting until nearly 6 months later, the wheel would have been ready for the fair's May 1st opening. Not only did the exposition lose its 50% share of the wheel's revenue for those 51 days, it lost the boost in overall admission that the wheel likely would have generated, and that Burnham so desperately wanted. Instead, it had stood for that month and a half as a vivid advertisement of the fair's incomplete condition. Safety fears lingered, and Ferris did what he could to ease them. The souvenir pamphlet noted that even a full load of passengers had no more effect on the movements or the speed than if they were so many flies. An oddly ungracious allusion. The pamphlet added, In the construction of this great wheel, every conceivable danger has been calculated and provided for. But Ferris and Granau had done their jobs too well. The design was so elegant, so adept at exploiting the strength of thin strands of steel, that the wheel appeared incapable of withstanding the stresses placed upon it. The wheel may not have been unsafe, but it looked unsafe. In truth, it seems too light, a reporter observed. One fears the slender rods which must support the whole enormous weight are too puny to fulfill their office. One cannot avoid the thought of what would happen if a high wind should come sweeping across the prairie and attack the structure broadside. Would the thin rods be sufficient to sustain not only the enormous weight of the structure and that of the 2,000 passengers who might chance to be in the cars, but the pressure of the wind as well? In 3 weeks, that question would find an answer. Rising wave. And suddenly they began to come. The enthusiasm Olmsted had identified during his travels, though still far from constituting a tidal wave, at last seemed to begin propelling visitors to Jackson Park. By the end of June, even though the railroads still had not dropped their fares, paid attendance at the exposition had more than doubled, with average daily paid attendance for the month rising to 89,170 from May's dismal 37,501. It was still far below the 200,000 daily visitors the fair's planners originally had dreamed of, but the trend was encouraging. From Englewood to the Loop, hotels at last began to fill. The roof garden cafe of the Woman's Building now served 2,000 people a day, 10 times the number it had served on opening day. The resulting volume of garbage overwhelmed its disposal system, which consisted of janitors bumping large barrels of fetid garbage down the same 3 flights of stairs used by customers. The janitors could not use the elevators because Burnham had ordered them turned off after dark to conserve power for the fair's nightly illuminations. As stains and stench accumulated, the restaurant's manager built a chute on the roof and threatened to jettison the garbage directly onto Olmsted's precious lawns. Burnham retracted his order. The fair had become so intensely compelling that one woman, Mrs. Lucille Rodney of Galveston, Texas, walked 1,300 miles along railroad tracks to reach it. "Call it no more the white city on the lake," wrote Sir Walter Besant, the English historian and novelist, in Cosmopolitan. "It is dreamland." Even Olmsted now seemed happy with it, although, of course, he had his criticisms. He, too, had wanted to manage the first impressions of visitors by having a central entry point. The failure of this idea, he wrote in a formal critique for the Inland Architect, deducted much from the fair's value, although he hastened to add that he was making this criticism not in the least in a complaining way, but as a professional offering guidance to others who might confront a similar problem. He still wished the wooded island had been left alone and decried the unplanned proliferation of concession buildings that intercepted vistas and disturbed spaces intended to serve for the relief of the eye from the 2 nearly constant demands upon attention of the exposition buildings. The effect, he wrote, has been bad. Overall, however, he was pleased, especially with the process of construction. "Really," he wrote, "I think that it is a most satisfactory and encouraging circumstance that it could be found feasible for so many men of technical education and ability to be recruited and suitably organized so quickly and made to work together so well in so short a time. I think it a notable circumstance that there should have been so little friction, so little display of jealousy, envy, and combativeness as has appeared in the progress of this enterprise." He attributed this circumstance to Burnham. "Too high an estimate cannot be placed on the industry, skill, and tact with which this result was secured by the master of us all." Visitors wore their best clothes as if going to church and were surprisingly well-behaved. In the 6 months of the fair, the Colombian Guard made only 2,929 arrests, about 16 per day, typically for disorderly